Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Weather Channel has decided to re-emphasize something in an effort to turn around some soft ratings. Would you care to guess what it is? That would be the weather. The network unveiled a redesign last week that will enable viewers to see their local forecasts on screen whenever they tune in, even during commercials. The network is also increasing its capacity to cast aside regular programming during severe weather conditions. The Weather Channel's trying to walk a fine line here by keeping us weather nerds interested while providing shows that people will watch more than 5 or 10 minutes at a time. So that's the balancing act that they try to walk at the Weather Channel. And as it turns out, the Weather Channel this year has seen its lowest ratings in 5 years or so. So some changes there amongst your local on the eights. A reminder that you are invited to join key members here of our Current State team tonight at Schuler Books in the Eastwood Town Center. You're encouraged to share your thoughts and ideas about our show. What do you like? What do you dislike? Recommend some changes? Recommend a story idea? We're all ears at Schuler Books, Eastwood Town Center. See you anytime this evening between 6 and about 8 o'clock. On our program at the top today, among the many federal government agencies and programs affected by the across-the-board spending cuts known as sequestration, which took effect last March, is the National Institutes of Health. Arguably the most important funder of biomedical research in the world, the NIH had its 2013 budget cut by 5%, which amounted to $1.5 billion, and about 640 research grants that were not issued. As Congress's budget impasse lingers without a long-term resolution, continued cuts to NIH threaten the progress of medical research on such vital projects as new cancer drugs and a universal flu vaccine. Sally Rocky is the Deputy Director for Extramural Research at the National Institutes of Health. She was here on the MSU campus yesterday, and I caught up with her to discuss the new funding reality for biomedical research and to find out just how important NIH funding is to universities.
So NIH is the largest funder of biomedical research in the world, and our primary source of expertise is the universities. They receive the largest portion of our grants. For Michigan, the state of Michigan, obviously NIH is very important both here at MSU and also at the University of Michigan, where we support some phenomenal research that's going on. But as a whole, NIH is probably the most important enterprise to see important entity to see this enterprise go forward.
We've spoken with scientists here at Michigan State who say that the sequester has really ramped up the competitive climate for grant funding. From your vantage point, how has the sequester impacted the way NIH conducts scientific research?
Due to the sequestration last year, NIH lost about 5.5% of its funds, and we fund most of our grants by what's called a continuation, which means we had commitments to grants that we had made in previous years. So the way we approached this was twofold. First of all, we cut all of our existing grants by a certain proportion, and then we made fewer new grants. So this has been particularly devastating for the biomedical research community, because a large percentage cut, like 5%, can have a great deal of impact on the pace at which we can conduct our research. And as you know, with science, we have to keep ahead of it and really be at the cutting edge. And when you slow anything down, like the sequester will have caused us, it can be particularly troubling.
With fewer dollars available, how has this changed your funding criteria? I imagine you've had to make some adjustments.
So NIH has been funding research competitively for about 70 years. So we started funding back in the 1940s. And we've gone through a myriad of changes in our peer review system over the course of those 70 years, as you probably can imagine. But we are a meritocracy, which means that we want the best ideas to come forward, and we will review those ideas. And when they align, they're high quality and they align with our priorities, we fund them. So while we have changed the nuances of our review criteria over the years, the real premise is that we want the best and the brightest and the best ideas to come forth at NIH. And so we want a system that's very adaptable to fostering those kind of creative ideas. And we believe we have that with our peer review system.
Many universities expanded with the growth of NIH grants over the last 20 years. Some say that they have overexpanded. What options are you looking at in this new climate?
I think what we're talking about here is that with a smaller NIH budget, that probably represents a constriction of the entire biomedical research enterprise because there's not as much funding going forth. So we had a number of years ago talked about many options, what we would do figure out how we best approach funding under tight budgetary times. And we bantered around a lot of different types of things like, for example, do you limit the number of applications a person submits? Do you limit the amount of money a person can receive? Do you limit the number of applications an institution may be able to submit, et cetera, et cetera? We had a long conversation with the community through my blog. We actually asked for comments, and we had quite a bit of communication back and forth. As a result of that, the only thing we did at that time was to institute a policy by which very highly funded individuals get a second look at any future applications if they have more than $1 million of direct costs with NIH. So if they come in with another application after that and it's highly scored, it's looked at by our advisory councils to determine whether or not we want to put additional funds in a highly funded laboratory. It does not represent a cap on the number of applications a person can submit. It just means that we're going to take a second look. And at this point, that's all we've done. We've tried to spread the wealth of the cuts that we received through sequestration by cutting all of our grants and or reducing the number of new competing grants we can make. But those are the approaches we've done so far.
In an article last week in the Chronicle of Higher Education, you mentioned the possibility of requiring universities to limit their number of grant applications. That would appear to have a profound impact. Where does that stand?
So that was one of the ideas that we talked about a couple years ago. In fact, I did a blog on that because I was quoted in the Chronicle this week to say that is something that we thought of early but dismissed early. You know, again, we're a meritocracy. We want all the best and creative ideas to come forth. So, but it is a problem. I mean, the increasing number of applications means there's more competition for the whole community.
We've heard that many postdocs and young scientists are leaving the field because of the lack of research dollars. What do you make of this? Is there a real threat to our next generation of scientists here?
I think there's a couple of things that are coming into play. One is just the funds available for supporting the research when you become an independent scientist. So I think postdocs are thinking about that. It's a great concern to them. But secondly, the sheer length of time it takes to get through the training period and the postdoc period until you're an independent scientist may also turn away some people from even pursuing careers in biomedical research. However, I will say right now we have still an enormously large and vibrant research community with many graduate students and postdocs. We have not seen a large constriction of the number of people entering graduate school, although Vanderbilt just announced that they were going to take 10% less PhD and medical school students. That was just in the paper yesterday. I think that it is something that postdocs will think about. At this point, I don't think people are turning away, but you also have to look at the amount of investments other countries are making in science as opposed to the United States. And the United States has been seeing its cuts to science and research, where other countries such as China and India are growing quite substantially. So the attractiveness of or the ability to find jobs in the United States might be compromised in the future if we don't make a decision about how we invest in science.
And how do these cuts impact the economy more broadly? Why should lay people care about this?
As you know, and most people probably realize, is that our economy is technology-based. Much of what the engine of our economy is science and the technologies associated with new and innovative ideas that come forth through science. So research in itself is a investment because the economic return on research is generally at least twofold, if not more. And so we should think of research as an investment, because it does have such an enormous impact on our economy. All of the most recent technological advances that you can think of all have science behind them. So even things like cell phones and all of the technology behind them have a great deal of science that's been funded somewhere. So I think it's very important to think about this and that we make choices to determine how we invest in science going forth in the future. Our economy and our whole future depends on it.
We're talking with Sally Rocky. She's the Deputy Director for Extramural Research at the National Institutes of Health. Are you anticipating another federal budget impasse?
A couple things are going to happen. We have the House and Senate that are working towards a budget, and they're supposed to report out by December 13th. If they have a budget that they report out by then, it may be possible that we'll go back to a normal order and get a budget for 2014. If not, in January, then we face a potential budget uncertainty, because at that point they have to decide whether or not to extend the continuing resolution. And also on top of that is sequestration. So sequestration will go into effect or be in effect still if, for example, they don't resolve the budget and the sequestration issue and we go forth with continuing resolution. So there's all sorts of things that are all entangled in December and January. And then in 15, we reach the debt ceiling again. So we have a very, very unusual time for us. We're hoping that calm prevails and that we won't go through what we just went through with the government shutdown. I think as the head of NIH, Francis Collins has said many times, he's used the term the pointless shutdown, because for science in particular, we went through 2.5 weeks without being able to conduct our science, for example, on campus, and that really does have an impact on the long-term viability of the enterprise. So we're hoping that we're going to make it through and that calmer heads will prevail.
Do you feel you have Congress's ear on these issues?
NIH enjoys very bipartisan support. Congress are great proponents of NIH, but I think it's very understandable, given the economic constraints, that there's a lot of competing priorities for Congress. So I think it's a very difficult time for everybody concerned in trying to decide where to put these precious taxpayer dollars.
Do you have a plan should the federal budget impasse continue?
So we're going to approach it. It'll depend on what happens, I think, largely with the sequestration. If the sequestration is still in play, then we're going to have to approach it in similar ways as we did in the previous years. My understanding is that while we experienced a 5.5% cut in the previous sequestration, we would actually have a 7% cut if the sequestration occurs this year. And that's the plan for the future. Over a 10-year period, that represents about a $20 billion cut to NIH over 10 years. So this is truly devastating for us. So we have already been talking about what would happen if sequestration remains in effect to both our continuing awards and our competing awards. Obviously, we would not be able to make as many new awards like in previous years, and we would have to also take cuts to our existing awards, who represent 3/4 of all the funding that we currently have. So, but we are thinking about it. It does not mean, though, we aren't resting on our laurels. We still are pursuing areas of opportunity in science. So, for example, we have just announced the BRAIN Initiative, which is a really amazing initiative to understand all the circuitry within the brain and what those circuits control. We are continuing and supporting fundamental basic science. We're looking towards trying to develop a universal flu vaccine. All of these kind of things, we're not going to stop because of our budget constraints. We just have to be thoughtful in how we do it.
How are these budget constraints playing out in other countries, and how do they impact what's going on in the United States?
So the major budget constraints for science is that the U.S. in real dollars, as well as a proportion of the GDP, is reducing its investment in science, where other programs, including China and India in particular, are growing exponentially. So this, we are a global enterprise. We work together, but it does make a difference as far as the view of the U.S. as a leader in science. And also for students who still flock to the United States for training in science. So you can imagine in the long term, if our investment doesn't stay strong and healthy, then students are going to seek elsewhere, and leadership will probably go elsewhere. So it's essential for the United States, who has its history just embedded in our scientific advancements and our scientific enterprise, to think about how we're going to manage this going forward.
Sally Rocky is the Deputy Director of Extramural Research at the National Institutes of Health. We've been talking about the funding climate for scientific research across the country. Sally, thanks for taking time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Throughout the 20th century, large investments of time and money were made to help restore big game populations across the United States. Many of these efforts were successful and continue today. However, that success may be short-lived. A new report from the National Wildlife Federation says climate change could negatively impact many big game species such as deer, elk, and bear. Frank Selassie is the Great Lakes Regional Outreach Coordinator for the National Wildlife Federation, and he helped compile the report. Frank Selassie, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark. Happy to be with you.
For years, we've worked to restore big game populations in the United States. Tell us just a little bit about that effort, please.
Sure. About 100 years ago, many of these big game species were hunted to the point of either extinction or near extinction. Through the 19th century. The conservation movement started under President Theodore Roosevelt and others. He was moved by the big game and the declining numbers of big game that he saw out on the Great Plains.
And that he was responsible for to one extent or another, if I have my history right.
That's correct.
He was an enthusiastic hunter, wasn't he?
No question about it. And hunting is where National Wildlife Federation traces its roots to the New Deal. We were the General Biological Survey under President Franklin Roosevelt, who often, in many cases, wanted to try to outdo his older cousin as president, and he collected birds as a young man, and so he was greatly concerned about wildlife, and he organized a conference of hunters and conservationists at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, where the Biological Survey started, and which spun off, as many New Deal programs did, to a private entity, which is now known as the National Wildlife Federation. So, this has been our subject of concern for many, many years, and we pulled together folks who had been with National Wildlife Federation decades ago to seek their input on what they've seen change in their favorite hunting grounds over the course of their life. And unfortunately, the anecdotes and the science point to a threat.
What big game animals are most common in Michigan today?
Sure. I have a lot of black-tailed deer, white-tailed deer. We have also some moose up in the Upper Peninsula. We're seeing changes in their habitat. Some of the trees that they had previously used to do winter bedding have shifted north as the climate has changed, and they've also endured greater stress from the parasites that are also moving into Michigan at a higher clip, thanks to the warmer winters.
What's happening to those populations, though? Maybe we should tick through a few of the better-known big-game animals here in Michigan, and you can tell us exactly what's happening to those populations. White-tailed deer, are they going up or down?
White-tailed deer presently are stable or going up, but that is somewhat of a... The problem with the white-tailed deer is that as this population continues to expand, it is spreading hemorrhagic disease caused by viruses from the biting midges and insects called noceums. These longer summers are exposing more and more deer to these disease-carrying midges. And unfortunately, some of the ticks that also hop along on these deer bring Lyme disease and other threats to humans, other animals, including domesticated pets. So it's a very complicated story. Some animals are going to find warmer winters generally to be better for them, such as white-tailed deer. Unfortunately, it's also better for the parasites that come with them.
Mm-hmm.
So the white-tail deer is an interesting case in Michigan.
Which Michigan big game animal are you most concerned about vis-a-vis climate change?
Sure. Clearly the moose. The moose have been subject to considerable restoration efforts from Isle Royale to other parts of the Upper Peninsula. The increase that wildlife managers have seen over the course of the past 10 years as a result of the investment that the state has made into restoring the moose, those numbers are starting to level off. Scientists aren't exactly sure why. They do know that moose populations are declining rapidly across Lake Michigan in Minnesota, past Wisconsin and into Minnesota. And the moose population is leveling off so quickly, of course, that Michigan had the opportunity this year to have an inaugural moose hunt, but because of the decline in the rate of expansion for the moose, the reproduction, wildlife managers and others just basically canceled the season. That also happened in Minnesota, and it's precipitous declines in Minnesota, precipitous declines in the upper New England area.
Drought is another major impact mentioned in this report. How would drought impact big game ecosystems in Michigan?
Sure. Drought's going to put stress on animals in that they're going to have to move farther and farther to find water to drink. As water gets warmer, levels of toxins are also going to accumulate faster in the water. As the water drops, the toxins in the water become a greater share of if the water level drops, the ratio of toxins to water increases, and that's not good for animals either. Probably the largest impact on drought would be the some of the aspens and some of the other trees that are basically trending north. The range for some of these trees that deer have used for winter bedding are trending north, and it's leaving Michigan quite candidly with fewer trees for deer to bed in the winter, exposing them to more severe conditions at different points of the year.
We're talking with Frank Solasi, the Great Lakes Regional Outreach Coordinator for the National Wildlife Federation, on the possible impacts to Michigan big game due to climate change. Are there any big game animals that might benefit from climate change in Michigan?
When you think about black bears in the Upper Peninsula, they're going to have to forage more out of their traditional habitat in search of food, often into areas of human habitation and development. Although wolf aren't big game, wolf numbers are increasing, and they're not exactly sure if there is a climate impact there, or whether or not they're pursuing the deer in other things that are expanding in certain parts of the state. It's hard to see what good can come from it. I mean, it's going to put greater stress on big game, and it's certainly putting greater stress on the whole food chain in Michigan's wildlands, from the Great Lakes to shallower lakes and our streams and rivers.
Does the report recommend any action to help curb the effects of climate change?
It does, largely in a couple of broad categories. One, we need to address the underlying cause of our climate risk and cut carbon pollution as a state, as a country, and globally. There's a plan to do that, and we need to speak up to our elected officials to follow where the science is leading and take steps to cut carbon pollution. That means that a transition to cleaner and more secure sources of energy and also energy efficiency. So that's you know, there are a number of steps within that broad approach. Mm-hmm. The second broad approach is safeguarding wildlife and their habitats by promoting climate smart approaches to conservation, and that means factoring in climate and comprehensive planning, more money for research at Michigan institutions, and for researchers to come into the state to monitor.
We are out of time. We got to leave it there, but we want to thank Frank Selassie of the Great Lakes. He is the Great Lakes Regional Outreach Coordinator for the National Wildlife Federation. He helped compile the National Wildlife Federation's report on big game and climate change. Thank you, Frank.
Thanks, Mark. Have a great day.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. In the late 1980s. New York City was a city divided. While wealth was rolling in from the booming financial industry, neighborhoods were falling apart. Drug wars and crime plagued the city. Ken Burns' film, The Central Park Five, reminds us of the atmosphere of the time.
All of a sudden, teenagers have lots of cash and guns. And all hell breaks loose in Bedford-Stuyvesant. All hell breaks loose in Harlem. All hell breaks loose in Brownsville, East New York. We were supposed to be afraid. It would have been irrational not to be afraid.
Amid these tensions, on the night of April 19, 1989, a young white woman was raped in Central Park and left for dead. The city was outraged by the crime, and the next day, police arrested five black and Latino teenagers, and the media frenzy began.
In New York City this morning, a jogger is fighting for her life after a brutal attack in Central Park.
Viciously battered and unconscious, wearing only a jogging bra, her hands tied over her mouth.
The suspects are 14 and 15-year-olds who blazed a nighttime trail of terror.
Assaulting an elderly man, attacking a male runner, hitting another person with a lead pipe. At one time, the group was running in a pack of more than 25 youths.
With scant incriminating evidence, coerced inaccurate confessions, and no eyewitnesses, Antron McRae, Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, Corey Wise, and Yousef Salaam were convicted of rape. More than a decade later, Mattis Reyes, a convicted serial rapist, confessed to attacking the Central Park jogger. A positive DNA match backed up his claim, and the five were exonerated. In 2003, the men filed a lawsuit against the city of New York for malicious prosecution, racial discrimination, and emotional distress. 10 years later, the case is still not settled, but recent developments suggest it may be resolved soon. Last week, Ken Burns told HuffPo Live that when New York Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio takes office, he will settle the case. Two of the Central Park Five, Yousef Salaam and Raymond Santana, were in East Lansing for a film screening last week. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with the pair shortly after Ken Burns' announcement of de Blasio's intention to settle the case once and for all. This interview does address sensitive topics and may not be suitable for all listeners. After two decades, Yousef Salaam still remembers the night that changed his life forever.
April 19, 1989 was a notable day for me. I think I came home from school, and as I would always do, I probably changed my clothes and went outside to play. We lived in Schaumburg Plaza at the time, and it was something that, as children, we always did. You know, especially doing something like hanging out in Central Park. That was one of the most normal things that a child living across the street from Central Park would do. And the interesting thing about me is that I have a background in art and design and things like that. So I would always be interested in nature and Central Park, just taking long walks and just being absorbed by that whole thing. So it wasn't unfamiliar territory to me. This particular situation was something that I hadn't planned on. And subsequently, it definitely reshaped everything about my life from that day forward.
And Ray, what about you?
You know, there was school, and after school, I would usually, because I had 9 o'clock curfew, right, during school days. So I would usually go and meet up with some of my friends. And so on this night, I did the same thing. You know, what are we going to do? Let's meet up after school. Let's go hang out. And so what we like to do is, because I hung out with a couple of guys that were older than me, we would love to go to other neighborhoods, and they would link up with other people, and we would, you know, talk to their girls and stuff like that. And so this night, it just happened we were going to Schaumburg. And so we walked over to Schaumburg, and, you know, and there was a bunch of people out there, and we were hanging out. Who made the exact call to go into Central Park? I don't know. But me, as a 14-year-old, as a follower, hanging out with guys who were a little bit older than me, who were more experienced than me, I just went along. It was just another day. We hanging out, we going to visit another neighborhood, and after that, I go home. But it wound up not going home, going to prison, and coming back out 7 years later.
So there's a lot of chaos that night in Central Park. There's attacks on bikers. A young white woman is jogging in Central Park, and she's beaten and raped and left for dead. And at the time, this attack is unknown to you both, but shortly after, you're picked up by the police for questioning. What's running through your head as the police are coming to get you, Ray?
Terrified. You don't know what's going on. Afraid, because we were very naive at that point. We was, never had no run-ins with the law, you know, so this wasn't something we was accustomed to. So everything is unfamiliar. So you don't know what's going to happen next. You know, all you know is that you're going to the precinct and they say, well, we're going to give you a DAT ticket, you know, to appear in court. And we're going to call your families and tell them to come pick you up. And so we were given, like, misdemeanor charges, you know, trespassing, menacing, stuff like that. It was nothing serious. It was all misdemeanor charges with an appearance in family court. And that's all we thought was going to happen. You know, we didn't even know that they had found a woman in the park. You know, they never told us anything. You know, they just, you know, as parents started to come and they got very late, they said that they had to hold us because some detectives wanted to talk to us. And that's all we knew. We didn't know what actually transpired with the woman until we got into those interrogation rooms.
Yusuf, when does the mention of this rape come up? And when it does, what's running through your head as you're hearing about these events?
So the interesting part about my addition to the story is that I was picked up the next evening. And I had went home, got ready for school for the next day, and went to school the next day and came home. And I said, wow, there's a lot of unmarked police officers outside. And in saying that, one of the older guys heard me and said, you know, they're looking for you. I said, they're looking for me for what? You know? And he said, well, there was a woman raped in Central Park. Did you hear about it? And I said, a woman raped? I said, I mean, I saw a lot of crazy stuff in the park, but I didn't see a woman get raped. And that was really my first part or my first introduction to hearing anything about this. And so I said, well, I know I didn't do anything. I'm just going to go to the police and, you know, let them know I didn't do anything. And that's going to be that. And the worst thing that I could have done was have that mentality and then go to the police department and come home 7 years later. We were so scared and so overwhelmed by what was going on because, like Ray said, at that point in time, I was being brought into a situation that had went from 0 to 100 just like that. It went from the Central Park police officers investigating some stuff that had happened to now Manhattan North
homicide detectives,
the elite. You know, the elite of New York City Police Department now stepping in and saying, we'll take over from now. And, you know, I became a poet. And in one of my poems, I say something like, we didn't have a chance, six youth among apes. In many ways, I think the title of Sarah Byrne's book, which is also the title of the Central Park 5 film, the subtitle of it is A Chronicle of a City Wilding. And this is exactly what they did to us. You know, they trumped up these charges and made it appear as if these are the guys who did this. You know, and as we all know, if it's in the papers, it's true, right?
If it's in the papers, it's true. That's what I heard. That's what I heard. So eventually police begin to interrogate you guys about the rape and beating, and confessions are made. Everyone's implicating that other people in this group of five are there. I feel like a lot of people would ask, why confess if you didn't do it? Can you kind of try and take me through that thought process of when you're being interrogated and why there's these confessions, Ray?
I always tell people that to understand why a person confessed, you have to understand the dynamics that go into that. So first off, you know, you have 14, 15, 16-year-old kids who have no police history, nothing. So now you walk into a situation that's unknown, right? And so now, like you said, you have the elite of the police force. These guys have been on the force over 20 years. They know how to do this stuff in their sleep. So the scale is already tipped. So now you put us in a room. It's cold. There's no food. There's no water. You know, you don't get none to drink. You have to stay up. There's no sleeping. And they're pounding questions. And, you know, in the beginning, they don't start off aggressive. They start off very calm. Tell us what happened, right? And you go into the story, tell them what you saw. That's not good enough. Because as they're doing interrogations, there's Elizabeth Lederer and Linda Fairstein who are out there and they're conducting an investigation. They're acting as lead investigators. And so while they're doing that, they're bringing back what they think are the facts and they're giving it to the police. And so they're bringing it to us, right? So, you know, like the story's already chopped up as it is. There is no truth in there. So they're just giving us what they perceive to be the facts. And so it starts off very, you know, harmless, and as it keeps going on into the wee hours, they become more aggressive. You know, my grandmother, who was there, spoke very little English. They knew that. They had to translate. And so what they would do is, you know, you hear a knock at the door. An officer would come in. He spoke Spanish. He told my grandmother in Spanish, "Can you step outside? Let me talk to you." Once she stepped outside and that door closed, that was it. This is where they start to do what they're going to do. So, you know, they bring officers in who are very high, very tall, they're towering. They start making, they curse at you, and they act like they're going to hit you, physically attack you. And you hear the knock at the door, everything stops. My grandmother comes back in, and all she sees is her grandson is shook. You know, he's shaking. She don't know what's going on. And when she tries to ask, "We're just trying to find out what's going on here. We don't know. We think he's holding something back." And that goes on for hours. And so once they got me to the point of where they know we're about to break them, they know. You know, these guys are professionals. And in my instance, there was another detective by the name of Detective Hardigan, right, who I don't remember when he got into the room, but I knew he was there. Again, the knock comes at the door. My grandmother steps out. Now, at this point, the guy who's interrogating me, his name is Detective Arroyo. He gets fed up. He bangs on the table. "I'm tired of this. You're going to give me what I want?" He goes to reach for me. At this point, I'm like, "Oh, this is it. I'm not going to make it out of here." But something happens. This other detective comes out from the back. He stops him. "What are you doing?" Starts yelling at him, cursing, push him out the room. "Get out the room." They just ran the good cop, bad cop.
Classic good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
Classic. They did it to a T. And right there, I'm like, this guy just saved my life. And then right there, he starts to perform his magic. "Ray, I need your help. Do you know this kid?" "I don't know Kevin Richardson." "Well, I need your help. We know he did it. He's going to jail. I don't want you to go to jail. You're a good kid. This isn't you. I need your help." So right there, I start to formulate a lie, right? And so Kevin was the first person. "Kevin. Okay, Kevin. What did Kevin do?" "I don't know. I seen him struggle with the woman." But he's writing this stuff down, you know? And so he gave me the names, and I just put them in. Once my statement is finished, and he says, "You know, you're a good kid, I'm going to help you, don't worry about nothing." All right, I'm thinking, I got the upper hand. Mm-hmm. So he says, "Look, but I need you to do one more thing for me. I need you to go to another precinct and give this same statement to somebody else and do a video." And so to me, it's part of the package deal. You want to go home? You got to help out. Fine. But in the process, my statement goes from 2.5 pages to 5 pages, from 5 pages to a video. And when you read the statement, it's all wrong. You know, at approximately 1,700 hours, you know, me and 40 of my friends went into the park and we traveled southbound. Doesn't even sound right.
You know, they swept a lot of things under the rug. They stepped over the bounds of the law. Mm-hmm. You know, they went into other people's job profiles and did their jobs. You know, and this is a big, big problem. But this doesn't just happen in New York City.
It happens everywhere.
It happens everywhere.
That's right.
Right here in Michigan. So you're tried and you're found guilty. What is your reaction to that and the fact that you're going to go to prison as a 14-year-old kid, man. Ray?
You know, in the beginning, it was hard because, like Yusuf said, you know, it wasn't, you know, you had all this stuff that we saw as 14, 15-year-old kids, you know, And we're like, how come the public doesn't see this stuff? You know, how come is it that, you know, you can go in and you can take all this forensic evidence? They took our clothes, you know, they hair samples, hand and footprints. You know, they took blood samples. They did everything. And nothing matched, right? And this was a, you know, this was a bloody crime scene. They said that they thought she wasn't going to make it, you know. And so that alone, and then you look at the statements themselves and all the discrepancies, you know, and you're like, how come nobody sees this stuff? How come is it that nobody's actually, as a whole, you know, speaking up? On the other side, we were just looked at as the worst human beings on earth. There were 400 articles written on us within the first 2 weeks of this case, dissecting our lives. They went to our schools, they went to our neighborhoods, they put our names, they put our addresses and our telephone numbers in the newspaper. We received death threats. Our family members received death threats. You know, my dad developed a drinking problem because he got ridiculed so much at work. I mean, it got so bad for us that we knew we was gonna lose. We knew we were gonna be found guilty because we had a meeting with our lawyers. And the lawyers told us, they said, we're not gonna win.
You're listening to Current State. I'm Emmanuel Berry. I'm here speaking with Yusef Salam and Raymond Santana, two of the Central Park Five. Yusef, what did you lose when you went to prison?
I think it's more than just saying that we lost our youth, you know. I mean, we lost every hope of trying to become a successful person. You know, I mean, we had gone to prison. We had been found guilty and we'd gone to prison for such a heinous crime. The only crime that trumped rape is to go to prison for child molestation. The inmates had been polled on what they was gonna do to us when we got to prison. And we knew that our lives was over. So I'm trying to give you an understanding that should point to the fact that to have this stigma on your back and then, you know, going into a space that you have no knowledge of, you know, the belly of the beast, you lose your innocence, you lose your youth, you lose your vision, you lose hopes for the future, you lose everything. And when I say every, I mean everything. When you become a lost soul, you become worse than the worst free person that's living on the streets, you know? And it puts you in a space that's hard to get out of. Of course, we all know that we never had a prom. We know that we, you know, most of our first, you know, relationship experiences was when we were adults. You know, we didn't know how to fill out job applications until we became adults. All of these experiences that young people kind of gradually come into, we didn't get any of that. So sometimes it's hard to speak about what we lost because we were just coming into ourselves.
It was eventually determined that Matias Reyes, a serial rapist, committed the crime you were convicted of. Interestingly, he was in jail with another of the Central Park Five, Corey Wise, and they spoke.
The whole thing about Corey's involvement with Matias Reyes happened because Corey was on Rikers Island for the time that he was on Rikers Island for. And he happened to be on Rikers Island at the same time the known Eastside rapist was there, which was Matias Reyes. When he saw Corey some 13 years later, 10, 12 years later, it was like, after being in prison for so long, after getting God, after realizing, I think, some of the mistakes that he had made, and he wasn't, you know, completely free of all of that, you know, but there was something in that, seeing the hurt and the pain in Corey's eyes and saying, oh man, I gotta come clean. I didn't realize this guy was still in prison for this crime. I committed the crime. It's a relief that the truth came out. But when I tell you that relief was short-lived, I mean, my mother was at City Hall, and she was talking about when we got exonerated. And, you know, as Raymond said earlier, there were over 400 articles written within the first few weeks that this case had come out. We hadn't even gone to trial yet, and this is how much people were writing about it. She said she had, you know, when they found out that we were innocent, it was a whisper that she had wondered if the mice heard. People to this day still think that we're guilty.
Because they don't know about exoneration.
They don't know about that.
They don't know.
You know, and when they see this film, like a lot of people, especially young people, you show them, you tell them about the Central Park Five, they think it's a rap group or a music group, you know. But for the older folks who remember that time, it's like watching this film, they're trying to figure out themselves, like, how did we believe that? How did we buy into this false story? I mean, for the first time, we're seeing this with new eyes, and we're realizing we got the wrong people.
Do you feel like this film is giving you relief? Yeah. I mean, is this part of the relief for you guys?
Because what happens is that when those false videotape statements came out, people believe that because it's a visual, right? So it's like, no matter what the evidence is, he's saying he did it, he must have did it, that's it. And so now the same thing happened in reverse now. Now you have a film, which is 2 hours long, of them telling of the facts. But now the difference is that it's us talking, and then now you have Mateus Reyes. And so now people watch this visual, and you see this for 2 hours, and it takes you on this emotional roller coaster, and you go, wow, I've been had also. Mm.
I mean, it's definitely given us our life back. You know, it's funny because of all things that could give us our life back, you know, you would think that being exonerated would have given us our life back. You would have thought that, you know, you would have thought definitely that we wouldn't have been fighting a lawsuit for 10 years. That right there is crazy in and of itself. But to be able to be on the radio with you, you know, to be able to be in front of folks and sharing with them, and this experience that happened to us, in many ways, has given us a chance to heal. We never went through any kind of therapy sessions or anything like that. And this has been tremendous for us in putting our lives back together. I mean, we can never get back what we've lost.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of moving forward, we've been able to help so many other folks just by letting them know, like, how we've been fighting. A lot of people have come to us and said, man, you guys are inspiring us. I mean, it's not even about, like, this film isn't really just about the Central Park Five. This film is about all of the injustices that go on, you know. And, I mean, we're out here and we're trying to make sure something like the Central Park Five never happens again.
You mentioned the lawsuit briefly, and in many ways the lawsuit is as close as you're going to get to an apology. Winning the suit is as close as you're going to get to an apology from a lot of people who owe you one, in a sense. Is there anyone in particular or that you would want to hear an apology from most?
You know, that's a difficult one because even though we would like to hear, we know we're not going to get them. And so, I mean, I think we're fine with that at this point. You know, I mean, during this lawsuit, we done conducted over 70 depositions, and to hear, you know, Elizabeth Lederer come in there and say that we're still guilty, to hear Fairstein come in there and say that we're still guilty, and all the detectives say all they did was good old-fashioned police work. And so we know we're not going to get the apology. And so, you know, to finally finish this case out, whether we go to trial or whether they settle, that is going to be the closure for us. That's the ultimate sign of victory. Because throughout this whole process, we have went in front of the city council. We have received proclamations from them. We have received proclamations from the state senate. You know, Attorney General supports us. You know, Eric Schneiderman. You know, the last city controller, which was John Liu, he spoke out. You know, let's get this case settled. Let's get these guys some justice. And so the only obstacle we had at the end of the day was Mayor Bloomberg.
And now we have a new mayor-elect, Bill de Blasio, and he's going to take office. And it was announced, or Ken Burns said on HuffPo Live, that he's going to settle the case. What does that feel like to know that this could all kind of come to an end soon?
I mean, you know, for me, it feels great, you know, because this has been a battle for over 24 years, and we have lost a lot of people in this process. And, you know, we're getting older. Our kids are getting older, and we feel like it's we're just looking for that time where we could just put a period at the end of this sentence and close this final chapter and then move on to something else. You know, whether it's injustice or programs with kids, and, you know, we have to move on to that next chapter in our lives. And it seems like we've been denied that opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
You know. Yusuf, yeah. What about
you? This has definitely ran us ragged, you know. I mean, man, to be able to finally say, okay, we don't have to go back to court anymore. We don't have to worry anymore. I'm not even talking about money. I'm not talking about money, because see, money doesn't erase the indelible scars, you know. It just so happens that financial compensation is the method that the city gives as a recourse when people are wronged, you know. But to be able to put this behind us finally, and to be able to move on without that hindrance, is tremendous.
Yusuf Salam and Raymond Santana, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Raymond Santana and Yusuf Salam were in East Lansing for a screening of the Ken Burns film, The Central Park Five. Last week, Burns told HuffPo Live that New York Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio has agreed to settle the 10-year-old Central Park Five case. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And that's our program for today. A quick reminder that you are invited to share your thoughts and suggestions for Current State. Tonight, submit an idea for a segment you know about. Let us know. Join us at Schuler Books, Eastwood Town Center, between 6 and 8 o'clock. That's Schuler Books, Eastwood Town Center, between 6 and 8. We'll be continuing these sessions in 2014. That's our program. We're back tomorrow. See you then. It's Current State on WKAR.